Welcome to Two-Way Street. Our guest today is University of Arkansas Distinguished Professor of History, Randall Woods. He's the author of Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society, and The Limits of Liberalism. Woods has written extensively about LBJ and the domestic political landscape of the 1960s. In this new book, he describes how Johnson was able to fight off fierce resistance and pass the sweeping series of measures known as the Great Society. Woods makes clear his admiration for Johnson's political skills and his vision for an American society that cares for its poor, elderly, and sick. But he also documents how some of Johnson's most ambitious plans triggered a conservative backlash that harmed the very people the Great Society was intended to help. My conversation with Woods was recorded in front of a live audience at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. Over the course of the next year, we're going to record a number of conversations at the library. Later in today's show, we'll tell you how you can get more information if you'd like to be in the audience for some of those shows. But now, our conversation with Randall Woods. Welcome, everybody. It's really a pleasure to be with all of you tonight. At the very beginning of your book, you say this: the presidential administration of Lyndon Johnson is remembered primarily for two matters, civil rights and the war in Vietnam. Except for the Civil Rights Act of 64 and 65, Johnson's domestic program, the Great Society, has largely been ignored, which is why this book is fascinating. It was perhaps the most comprehensive and ambitious effort to change the political, social, and economic landscape of the United States in all of the country's history. That's a very sweeping statement, but you clearly believe that's the case.
I do, and I'm sure I'll be subject to great criticism for that, but the Great Society was the culmination of the reform movement that began with populism, and you can see Johnson's grandfather was a populist, and you can see elements of populism and progressivism, and most certainly the New Deal in this. But the Great Society is unique, most people don't realize this, in of all the reform, 20th century reform movements, of taking on the issue of racial inequality directly.
You made a point that I'd really like to expand on a little bit, because you tell the story in the book. He comes out of a pretty liberal family, as you just said. His mother was a social activist Christian, right? What was the book that moved her, Rebecca read, that C.M. Shelton's In His Steps?
In His Steps. C.M. Shelton was one of the leading lights of the social gospel movement at the turn of the century, which, you know, Christianity was divided roughly, Protestant Christianity, between those who believed that the path to salvation was through cultivation of a personal relationship with God. Sheldon said, no, the path to salvation is through what you do for your fellow man.
And that's where it becomes important in terms of the whole notion that Johnson had of the Great Society. He himself had read The Grapes of Wrath, Johnson, you say, and been very moved by the plight of the migrants. Yes.
Yeah, Steinbeck was his favorite author. Lady Bird recalled that they saw the first movie version of it, and he cried, you know, he was very, could be an emotional slob, you know, I mean, but sentimental. But,
can't we all?
Yes, that's right. But he was very, very touched by that. And Steinbeck and he remained friends.
They did.
And Steinbeck was a big supporter of the war and Vietnam.
I think today, given the way politics in the South has evolved, especially in recent years, we can't imagine Johnson growing up in that kind of progressive household in Texas, I think. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. He grew up in Central Texas, the 10th Congressional District, which included Austin. There's Texas in the Republic of Austin, which is filled with communists and hairy-legged women, if you saw, you know. So if you saw the movie Bernie, it was a great... and when he was a congressman, representing the 10th Congressional District, he was an ardent New Dealer and quite liberal. Once he was elected senator, he represented a very conservative oil and gas state. And it really put the clamps on what he could do in terms of social and economic reform.
So let's pick up the story the day after John F. Kennedy is assassinated. Lyndon Johnson obviously had been sworn in on the flight back on Air Force One to Washington. And you say in the book that the day after Kennedy was killed, LBJ told an aide, "I am a Roosevelt New Dealer. In fact," he said, "Kennedy was a little too conservative for my taste." That's fascinating.
Right. That's right, yeah.
And he immediately went to work. You say that he sat up all night in those early days in the White House with a legal pad with his aides.
Horace Busby, Jack Valeni, Fortas was around, and it was, I think he was still in residence at the Elms, which was the vice presidential residence. He didn't move in.
Okay, so he wasn't at the White House.
Yeah.
But they immediately began sketching out
That's right.
The Great Society,
That's right.
The agenda that Johnson wanted to put in place. And you say that Fortas, at one point while they were sketching all this out, said, "You can't pass this stuff. You're certainly not going to pass civil rights." And Johnson said, "Well, what the hell is the presidency for?"
That's right.
So talk to us about that ambitious agenda that he started with from the very beginning.
The man on the day that Jack Kennedy was killed, according to his own recollection, he suspected that the Kennedys were going to drop him from the ticket. He thought that much less having presidential ambitions, he thought his public life was probably over. And suddenly he's president of the United States. Arguably, he probably never would have been president of the United States if it hadn't been for Kennedy's assassination. He just was too much of an old-fashioned politician. He really wasn't suited to television. So he was thrust into this office. And you can imagine what was going through his mind. Initially, he was obsessed with keeping the country from falling apart. No one knew who had killed Kennedy. Some people thought it was Southern segregationists. Certainly, they thought maybe it was a Soviet conspiracy. Johnson himself suspected it was Fidel Castro. So the country, and any of those things had been true, there would have been the possibility for deep division. So he wanted to bring the country together to heal it. But then at the same time, this project which had been in the back of his mind, all these dreams began to appear to him to be possible. He said in 1937, and when he was congressman, he said, gave a speech, he said, the New Deal is not something that's fixed in time. It's something that's organic and will grow over time. And to me, that was an indication that gives you some insight into the way he was thinking. Many of the ideas were his. Early in his presidency, he created some, I think, 16 task forces.
Yeah.
Which he insisted on keeping secret. Their deliberate.
Well, he was worried, you say, that anything that got out would start the critics working against him.
That's right. And the politician in him told him that any premature debate on these issues would polarize the country before he could work his political magic.
Before we get to what they were, you talk about how as he took office, he was keenly aware of the wound in the country as a result of the Kennedy assassination and felt this need to bring the country together. And so he, within the first, about a couple weeks after he was in office, went before a joint session of Congress.
That's right.
To give his first speech.
That's right.
You describe it very beautifully. Would you be open to reading just a little bit about what that was like and what it was like on the Hill that night?
Sure. As Johnson stepped to the podium, Congress, the nation, and the world held its collective breath. Who was this man, now president of the most powerful nation in history? Few questioned his competence, but what did that matter? Hitler had been competent. Would he be a front man for Southern segregationists, as many white Northern liberals believed, or a turncoat integrationist, as many white Southerners suspected? Where would he stand on foreign policy? Many at home and abroad feared that he would turn out to be a simple Texas jingo crying, "Remember the Alamo," willing to bring the world to the brink of nuclear destruction at the drop of a hat. Most important, Was LBJ a simple political fixer, or was he a man of principle with a value system that would promote the interests of peace, freedom, and social justice?
How was that speech received?
Very well. People breathed a sigh of relief. He was a figure of reassurance, which he very much wanted to be.
You have a nice moment in the book where LBJ is talking to a reporter about why he's about to pursue some of these big social programs. He said, "Some people get a chance late in life to correct the sins of their youth, and very few get a chance as big as the White House." Mm. Great quote.
Mm-hmm.
Great quote. Okay, so what did he start with?
Well, he needed was money. There are two things. Obviously, the most important thing on his agenda was civil rights. He understood that from a negative point of view, if the nation did not take action to bring a degree of racial justice to this country, there was going to be conflict in this country that made Vietnam hadn't happened yet, but Korea looked like child's play. He understood, and his advisors told him that African Americans were at the end of their rope, and the country had reached a turning point. But on the positive side, he believed that he could use Kennedy's assassination mm-hmm. and the idealism of Kennedy's inaugural address to unify the country. He also understood that there had been a religious revival in this country that had begun after the Second World War, which saw tremendous growth in not only evangelical and Protestant Christianity, but in mainstream Christianity and in the Catholic Church. Johnson is the president who most often quoted the Bible. Mm. Now, people are incredulous at this, that I would offer Johnson as a kind of Jimmy Carter. He was a believer. He became, under the pressures of Vietnam, the presidency, he became an intense believer. But he believed that he could use Christianity to confront white Americans. As he said later, he said, I couldn't make white Americans open their door to black people. I couldn't make them integrate their schools, but I could damn sure make them feel guilty if they didn't.
So you said he needed money, and so the first thing he had to do was pass a tax bill.
It passed the Kennedy tax cut. Now, this turns the economics on its head,
yeah.
in a sense, because you don't associate tax cut with the Democratic Party or with liberalism. But his economist, led by Walter Heller, argued that the country was not at full production. It was not at full production, and that's why we had underemployment. And a tax cut across the board would stimulate the economy,
right.
and create a full production, which would virtually eliminate unemployment. And it created, the Kennedy tax cut had the desired effect. One of the things that made the Great Society possible, which is relevant today, is that it was a period of rising prosperity. If you weren't a poor white Southerner or a black tenant farmer or lived in an urban ghetto, but for working class whites who worked in the auto industry and in other areas, things were getting better.
So he passes his tax cut, which opens the door for the beginnings of the programs that come under this whole umbrella title of Great Society reforms. And the first one is the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is the Public Accommodations
Bill. Equal Accommodations Act, that's right, and it's a sweeping bill which the Kennedy administration had introduced and was pending. Kennedy's could not get it through. He believed that if he could get that measure through, that it would open the door. Obviously, he couldn't persuade people like Richard Russell and Strom Thurmond to vote for it, but he believed that he could get them to acquiesce in it if it was passed.
You tell a really interesting story about his campaigning for this. 5 weeks after he was inaugurated or sworn in, wasn't really an inauguration, mm-hmm. sworn in as president, he spent New Year's Eve at the 40 Acres Club on the campus of your old alma mater, University of Texas. Who did he bring?
His black secretary, Jerry Whittington. The 40 Acres Club was about as segregated a place as you could get. And she said, Mr. President, are you sure you want to do this? He said, yeah, I want to do this. And half of them will think you're my wife, which is great.
Talk about a bold way to say where you stand on these matters. So he knew he was going to face a Southern filibuster. Mm-hmm. He knew that he was going to have to try to find votes for cloture to get the bill actually in a position where it could be voted on. And he started a pretty big campaign. He came to Georgia.
He did.
Let's talk about his visit to Georgia in the middle of that.
When he came to Georgia, in Atlanta and Gainesville, huge crowds turned out to.
Yeah, on May 8th, you say, he addressed a breakfast attended by members of the Georgia legislature in Atlanta. And you point out the city, of course, that Sherman had burned to the ground a century earlier. Governor and Mrs. Sanders, Carl Sanders, were there. So is Herman Talmadge. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. But not Richard Russell.
No.
He actually quoted in his speech the motto of the state of Georgia, you say, wisdom, justice, and moderation.
That's right.
Right? And then he went out and it was in a motorcade. What was the reaction like in the streets of Atlanta?
The streets were packed, cheering crowds. It was as if he were sort of a triumphal tribune.
And it wasn't as if Southerners, Georgians at that point, didn't know about his efforts to pass this civil rights bill. What do you imagine about that reception?
I can't say what was in their minds. I can say that the turnout and response was significant. Later on, he had Lady Bird tour the South, and the Lady Bird especially. He tried to put the white Southerners in a bind, catch them between their racism on the one hand and their chivalry on the other. And the tour ended in New Orleans. And he met Lady Bird and one of the daughters who was on the trip. And there was a huge crowd there, black and white. And he gave a very frank civil rights pep speech to that crowd. Richard Russell later said, only Lyndon Johnson could have made us swallow this. And he said, Jack Kennedy could never have got it done, but only one of our own could have gotten us to swallow this. And so Johnson continually argued that the civil rights measures were not only in the interest of African Americans, they were very much in the interest of white Southerners. That until and unless they put Jim Crow behind them, the region was going to continue to be a social and economic backwater. He would, at the same time he chastised white Southerners for their blind racism, he expressed sympathy with them.
Well, your book goes into great detail on how Johnson worked with the Senate to pass that first civil rights bill. Everett Dirksen, mm-hmm. The Republican senator of Illinois, was a big, big part of how he was able to make it work. You say after they finally voted for cloture, so the filibuster ended, they wore him down, essentially.
That's right.
And so the Senate voted for cloture. Everett Dirksen quoted Victor Hugo. He said, stronger than all the armies is an idea whose time has come. The time has come for equality in education and employment. It will not be stayed or denied. It is here. That's a really wonderful.
It is. The Johnson talked to Charlie Halleck, who was the Republican leader in the House, and a little rougher person than Dirksen. But he told Halleck. He said, Charlie, pardon me. God damn it. He said, you represent the party of Lincoln. Every other word out of your mouth is a tribute to Abraham Lincoln. How can you oppose this bill? You can't do it.
So he won the civil rights legislation, that first accommodations bill. One of the things you say in your book is that you point out there were no riots afterward, after the civil rights bill was signed.
No massive resistance.
And you speculate that it was because it was done by a fellow Southerner, not imposed from the North. And you say, I thought this is fascinating, it may have been seen as a gift to the nation from the South.
That's right. Yeah. He and Richard Russell had a very interesting relationship. And Russell was a very interesting and complex man. Russell told him, in effect, that the 64 Civil Rights Act, if passed by Congress, was going to be a lot easier to defend the South than a judicial edict.
He said that, get this right, that Southern segregationists who have a change of heart tend to be more sincere in that transformation than Northerners, I think, is essentially what you say in the book. Is that right?
Well, that quote came from Louis Morton,
who
was a black aide to Johnson.
Okay.
A lot of folks who are not from the South don't have any acquaintance with black folks.
Right.
That's not part of their culture.
You grew up in Chicago. You grew up in one of the most segregated cities in the country, as I did. You move here, and whether you're best friends or not, you are all in the same restaurants, the same bars. Interesting.
And you're probably related.
I'm talking to University of Arkansas Distinguished Professor of History, Randall Woods. His new book is Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society, and the Limits of Liberalism. We recorded the conversation in front of an audience at the Carter Presidential Library. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to University of Arkansas Professor of History, Randall Woods. His new book describes how Lyndon Johnson passed the sweeping reforms known as the Great Society. As we pick up the story, LBJ has just won the 1964 presidential election, despite concerns that Southern voters would turn against him for his successful effort to pass the Civil Rights Public Accommodations Act. So Johnson wins this sweeping victory. Wins by like 16 million
votes. Yeah.
Votes. 16 million votes. And despite the fact that Southern senators stood against him, he did well with Southern states. He didn't win Georgia, as I recall, right?
He carried six Southern states.
Yeah.
Of course, the greatest thing that ever happened to Lyndon Johnson was Barry Goldwater.
Goldwater won Georgia.
Yeah, well, I'm not. I'll leave Georgia out of it. And actually, Johnson got more Republican votes than Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, and that opens the floodgates. And we're not going to talk about each of them, but it's now time for his vision: Medicare, voting rights, with the second of the civil rights bills in '65, I think.
Yes.
Immigration reform.
Right.
But he started with education.
Right.
Talk about the education bill and why that really is a civil rights bill.
Yeah, well, both Medicare and the Elementary and Secondary Education Act are civil rights bills. And I say in the book that the sequence in which these bills were passed were important. Some of the principal opposition to federal aid education and to Medicare came from segregationists because they saw those bills as tools that could be used by the federal government to bring desegregation to the South. Once the federal government became an increasingly important funder of education, then it did become an engine to compel integration of the schools, just as Medicare became an engine to compel desegregation of Southern health facilities. He knew that. You could argue that the other components of the Great Society, Medicare, federal aid to education, clean air, clean water, consumer protection, were sops to the white middle class to persuade them to swallow civil rights bills.
Interesting, right.
Now, right. I think that's far too simple, but right. but there's something to that. There were certain issues which he really identified with, and racial justice, education, and health care. He identified with them personally because of personal experience. Yeah. And he really believed that education was the key to an enlightened society. He also believed that it was key to eliminating poverty. Johnson was about equality of opportunity. And the war on poverty was about, not about welfare, but about equality of opportunity, job training, rehabilitation, whether you agree with that or not, rather than guaranteed income.
So he always felt, as each of these bills marched through Congress, that he had to make it clear this was not about handouts.
That's right.
And yet, the unintended consequences, which your book, you know, there's a reason your book is called Prisoners of Hope, and you talk about the limits of liberalism. There were some significant unintended consequences of all the good work that LBJ thought that he was doing, and of course he was doing a great deal of good. I think we all understand that. But there was a lot of, it backfired in many ways.
Yeah, one of the classic examples which absolutely drove him crazy was that, again, the idea of eliminating poverty was job training, the Job Corps, rehabilitation, education. But the war on poverty created a separate bureaucracy, the Office of Economic Opportunity, which was responsible for community action. The OEO funded grassroots community action programs. And one of these led to the funding and creation of the National Welfare Rights Organization. And the National Welfare Rights Organization had its as its objective expanding the welfare roles as much as possible.
Yeah.
And it created, they hired a group of lawyers which represented welfare recipients who had been discriminated against for, they discriminated against single mothers who had men in the house whose children were truant from school, and so these lawyers represented them in court and got those rules removed. And so you have a massive expansion of the welfare roles during this period, which every conservative since Ronald Reagan has pointed out every minute of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
But to him, you know, he told Sergeant Shriver, who headed OE, said, you've got to cut that out.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to get these radicals under control. And he began to, Johnson believes that that the war on poverty needed, the OEO needed to work in harness with local Democratic political machines.
Well, and that's, yes.
And your friend Richard Daley, your
the mayor.
The mayor was an ardent supporter of the Great Society because it gave him a lot of largesse to distribute. But then the OEO began to sponsor rent strikes, and people were down at his city hall demonstrating, being supported by funds from the OEO. And Daley and other big city mayors rebelled.
And that's a really important point, because Johnson saw, he did see the value of giving community organizations, the grassroots organizers, a seat at the table
right.
to be part of the conversation, because he needed to create a coalition that would help get this legislation passed, and he'd have grassroots support. But what he didn't anticipate was just what you described, was that the mayors like Richard J. Daley and others across country and other political leaders would suddenly find themselves threatened by those very organizations and suddenly become more skeptical of Johnson's program.
Yeah, and what happened too, you know, after the civil rights began to move, movement began to move north. You know, I think Watts was in 65, and then you had the series of dramatic racial urban riots. This is another unintended consequence. Of course, it created a rising level of expectations among African Americans. But the movement moved north. Now, both Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson were Southerners. And when they thought about civil rights, they thought about the South and about Jim Crow. The civil rights issues in the North, as you know, were more complicated. They had to do with infrastructure. They had to do with transportation, physical isolation from jobs. They had to do with poor public facilities. They had to do with real and not just token political power. And so the community action in these northern cities were seized upon by black militants in the cities and used as forums and instruments to attack the system.
You create expectations, they're not completely fulfilled. It opens the door for frustration. Whitney Young, you quote Whitney Young. Do you happen to remember his quote? I have it here if you don't. He said, blacks might end up with, quote, a mouthful of rights and an empty stomach.
Right. Yeah, and Martin Luther King said, I've earned the right for my people to eat hamburgers. Now I've got to find some way to help them pay for them.
Yeah. So here's the other thing. You started talking about the riots. The rioting and the looting that took place in American cities, what it did was it kind of undermined the whole idea of the Great Society and gave the critics an opportunity to start passing law and order agendas, which were contrary to everything Johnson had hoped to accomplish.
Exactly. The urban rioting created a white backlash and gave rise to the war on crime movement. You see the emergence of Ronald Reagan. Increasingly, the war on crime, a rallying cry among conservatives in conservative coalition, became a war on the war on poverty. Because conservatives increasingly argued that they didn't make a distinction between criminal activity and urban unrest. They argued that urban rioting was a function of the dependency state that the Great Society had created, and that the Great Society had undermined individual initiative, that it created unrealistic expectations of government. It eroded any sense of personal responsibility. And of course, Johnson, for political reasons, was compelled to embrace the war on crime and bite his tongue and support the Safe Streets Act.
Johnson's lost both the conservatives and the liberals.
And the liberals. The liberals turn on him. He's being, by 66, 67, he's being attacked on the right by the new War on Crime Coalition, the new right. He's being attacked on the left by Bobby Kennedy,
yeah.
Who's trying who hates Johnson, and he wants to outflank him on the left. So Kennedy and Abe Ribicoff, senator from Connecticut, are holding what we call the city hearings in 66, 67, 68, in which they're blaming the urban unrest on Johnson for exactly the opposite reasons that conservatives are. You're not doing enough. You're engaging in tokenism.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation with Randall Woods. Welcome back to Two-Way Street and our conversation with University of Arkansas Distinguished Professor of History, Randall Woods. Woods has written a new book on Lyndon Johnson, which details how Johnson was able to pass his Great Society legislation. The show was recorded in front of a live audience at the Jimmy Carter Library. And we come to a very important moment, and you tell it so well in your book, and that's Lyndon Johnson. He's not sure that it makes sense for him to run for re-election, partly probably his own personal feelings about what he's gone through, but also to an extent, I think you make the point that he recognizes that maybe for the good of the country, he's become a symbol of discord and and is driving people apart. The opposite of what he hoped to accomplish that night, he went before a joint session of Congress and gave that speech.
Yeah, his decision not to run is a very complex one, and it's not one-dimensional. His doctors were telling he and his wife that he wouldn't live out another term.
Yeah.
Famously, Lady Bird had bought her funeral dress. She and John Connally, who he talked with, were advising him not to run. He believed, too, that he'd lost his effectiveness. He was deeply distressed by the divisions within the country. He reveled in the unity that he was able to bring to the country after he became president in 64. And his inability to heal the divisions that were becoming so deep by 68 caused him great frustration. He also had, as his daughters, he also had kind of a messiah complex, and it was easy for him to portray himself as a savior. And,
yeah.
And so he was, at least initially, deeply satisfied. He found the decision not to run, to sacrifice himself politically, deeply satisfying.
There are personal stories that are part of this, though. You say that on March 31st of 68, his daughter Linda comes back to the White House. She's been in California, where she saw her husband, Chuck Robb,
mm-hmm.
off. He's a Marine. Mm-hmm. He's
Captain
off to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. She's pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Someone, you quote in the book, says that she walked into the White House looking like a wraith from another world. She stared at her father and said, "Why do we have to go to Vietnam?" And Lady Bird later wrote, she had not seen a look of pain on his face
that
intense since he lost his mother.
Yeah. He was a man that was intensely involved in things. It was sometimes very difficult to break through to him, break into him, to his sort of personal core. And so in these kinds of incidents, I think, were rare, but very telling.
He had another moving moment that you describe. Literally the next, he's written the speech, or with help. I'm not quite sure who all was involved in writing that famous speech in which he said he wasn't going to run again, but he'd written it, and he drives to Hubert Humphrey's apartment, his vice president's apartment.
Horace Busby,
yeah. Tom Johnson says. Thank you.
Yeah, and Horace, if I'm not mistaken, there were several sections to the speech,
yes.
But Horace kept the withdrawal to himself.
It was the last paragraph.
Yeah, he wouldn't, it wasn't, nobody knew about it, but just a few people. He went and told Humphrey, and Humphrey teared up, and he said, "How the hell am I going to beat the Kennedys?"
Probably right.
He was right.
Part of that speech, Johnson said, "There's a divisiveness among us tonight, and holding the trust that is mine as president of all the people, I cannot disregard the peril to the progress of the American people and the hope and the prospect for peace for all people." And, of course, it was then that he said, "I will not run."
He'd had this conversation with John Gardner, who was HEW secretary and moderate Republican, sometime earlier. And Gardner said, "Mr. President, I've been thinking about this a good deal." And he said, "I'm sorry, but I just can't support you for another term in office because I think you've become a diversion. I don't think you can unify the country." And Johnson said, "Well, you know, I've had the same thoughts myself."
We often think of Johnson as a failed president because of Vietnam.
Right, right.
And often say that all of his accomplishments with the Great Society are overshadowed because of Vietnam.
Yeah, there's a very complex relationship between Vietnam and the Great Society. I make this point, which most of my colleagues who teach foreign policy intensely disagree with. But Johnson, when he made the decisions to escalate the war in 65, this was the time when he was getting the Voting Rights Act through. He was trying to get Medicare, federal aid to education, both of which were civil rights acts. So he's trying to get Southern segregationist and conservative Republicans to acquiesce in the passage of these measures. At the same time, the North Vietnamese had begun sending down regular army troops into the South Vietnam. and he's hearing that if we don't do something, South Vietnam's going to fall. Johnson's political calculation told him that he could not ask conservative Republicans and Southerners who were among the most hawkish elements in the country, to swallow both civil rights and a surrender to the communists. Right. And of course, on top of this, at the same time, J. Edgar Hoover and conservatives are trying to portray the civil rights movement as communist dominated.
Yeah.
And to make it even more complicated, in 66 and 67, Martin Luther King comes out in opposition to the war, which allows Hoover and other professional anti-communists to label the civil rights movement as communist dominated. Johnson was a powerful man and a political genius, but he was dwarfed by these kinds of forces.
We're going to take some questions now, because you've listened to us talk for quite a while.
Randall, tell them about the impact of Cotulla.
The impact of Cotulla. What is the impact of Cotulla?
Well, when Johnson was a senior in college, he went to Southwest Texas State, where my wife went, as a teacher's college. And teachers practice taught. And so he went to Cotulla, which is a small town in South Texas in the brush country. And his practice teaching consisted of being the acting principal of an all-Hispanic elementary school. What he did was to, and of course, discrimination against Hispanics in South and Central Texas was as strong as it was against African Americans in other parts of the country. The schools were strictly segregated. These kids weren't expected to go to high school. They were expected to learn enough to be toters of water and hewers of wood. Well, he went in there and he told them, he said, "You're Americans like everybody else. You're entitled to the same rights." He went to the school board and said, "We need funding for books. We need funding for athletic equipment. He was a debate coach. "I'm going to create a debate team here." He had an ally, a woman, who was a very powerful woman who was a liberal, who helped him achieve these things. But that experience, his commitment to social justice was not something that he gradually came to, but that it was just part of his person.
Thank you very much for that wonderful presentation. I'm sorry, I haven't read your book, but I read Caro, and there's several things. There's several things that stood out to me. One was the genius in his politics. Another was the story that you just told about his teaching at the Mexican school. What I'm really puzzled about the evolution of his ideas about race and blacks in particular, because was he always sympathetic to the black population as he later became, or was he initially? I think he was initially a segregationist, but so I'd like to understand evolution of his thinking about race and blacks.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Where he lived in Johnson City in the Hill Country, there are not that many African Americans. You had to go Austin 50 miles away. So it was like Bill Frost, somewhat of an abstraction. Hispanics were more important in changing his views, but he could be paternalistic. Among white Southerners, he'd use the N-word. But when he was head of the National Youth Administration in the 1930s, he went out of his way to see that that black colleges got equal funding from the federal government. When he became senator, represented the state, he gave a segregationist speech. One of his maiden addresses in Congress was segregationist. Busby said that when he got through, he came out and threw up. He was much more advanced than many white Southerners. My parents, for example, who were middle-class white people, they were very nice to African Americans as individuals, but when they thought about them in the abstract, they were racist. He was far advanced of those people.
You have a question?
I'm curious, given your academic work on Lyndon B. Johnson, what are your thoughts about the, I guess, popular depiction of him in the movie Selma, where it was not so presented in the way that you presented it tonight, where Johnson was much more proactive in the civil rights legislation, whereas in Selma, he was depicted as sort of going along and sort of kicking and screaming, in fact, in some instances.
That's right.
So I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, I thought it was a very erroneous depiction. I thought it was wrong. I think that the folks who created that film, which was magnificent in many ways, were engaging in dramatic license. I think a much more accurate depiction is The Butler, if you want to see a depiction of Johnson. If you look at the black communities, he certainly had his differences with Martin Luther King. But if you look at his relationship with, and it's easy to focus on urban unrest and rioting. That represented a tiny minority of the African-American community in this country. Every year he would have in the Rose Garden this huge meeting, which included black newspaper editors, black ministers from all over the country. And it was like Busby said, like a love fest. I mean, there was criticism and criticism of him because the Great Society didn't do enough, because the war on poverty was underfunded. But the depiction of him is being dragged, kicking and screaming along is absurd. He and Martin Luther King were different people and not close, but they worked in tandem. They worked in, they saw the absolute necessity of each other.
So let's conclude.
Okay.
You think the Great Society was a success, despite all of the documentation you have in here of places where it went wrong. You believe it was a great success in most ways, don't you?
Well, I do. I mean, I am a believer in religious terms. But beyond that, if you look at the founders of this country, they were committed to, they believed that a republic could not exist without the notion of public virtue. At the heart of public virtue is a willingness of the individual to make some sacrifice for the greater good. And they believed that the republic was the most beneficial form of government for all citizens, and that public virtue, a willingness to sacrifice for the greater good, was essential to the maintenance of the republic. And I believe that that's true.
Randall Woods, the book is Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society and the Limits of Liberalism. Thank you for being here at the Carter Presidential Library, but also thank you for speaking to us for Two-Way Street. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Been listening to my conversation with University of Arkansas history professor Randall Woods. It was recorded in front of a live audience at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. Lyndon Johnson's speech announcing his decision not to run for re-election was a remarkable moment in American history. If you'd like to watch it, we've posted it on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS. As I mentioned at the start of today's show, we're going to do a number of programs this year at the Carter Library, and we'd love to have you join us. We have two shows on the schedule in the next month. On Thursday, May 5th, we'll be at the library to talk with Princeton University research scholar Meg Jacobs. She's written a book called Panic at the Pump. It's a compelling look at the energy crisis of the 1970s, when the Arab oil embargo forced Americans to wait in long lines at gas stations and to turn our thermostats down low, and had us wondering if we were a nation in decline. Then on May 25th, we return to the library for a conversation with Andrew Young about his life as a civil rights giant, congressman, UN ambassador, and mayor. The Carter Library programs are all free of charge and start at 7 in the evening. You don't have to make a reservation. If you want more information about the programs, check our website. Remember, if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can listen to Two Way Street on your own schedule. You can download the Two Way Street podcast from iTunes or any other provider, or you can download the GPB Atlanta app for your mobile device. You'll find Two Way Street, Political Rewind, On Second Thought with Celeste Headlee, and some of your favorite NPR shows there, too. And if all that's not enough, all of our Two-Way Streets are archived on our website. That's all the time we have for this week. Our producer is the extraordinary Jenny Ament. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for being with us today. Hope to see you back here again next week for another Two-Way Street.